Good evening and welcome to episode 21 of the Outrider podcast. First thing, a little bit of an apology for the tardiness of this episode today. I ran into a bit of some knowledge problems last night while trying to finish up this this episode for today. Apparently there are some things with GarageBand that I forget how to do because I don't do them very often. And one of them arises from having some recording problems. So we had like two or three different recorded streams that I had to meld together with my guest, Stephen McClurg, here tonight because of some internet connectivity problems. And I forgot to merge all of those tracks. So at one point I had sliced and diced things to get rid of big, long silent spots when we tried to get reconnected and ended up like erasing part of his track so they didn't sync up. And it was just a nightmare. And it was like 11:30 when I finally gave up on Sunday night and got up early Monday morning and, you know, got everything lined up and squared away the way it was supposed to be. So, and then fortunately I had to go to work. So here I am. It's late Monday. I'm recording the intro and getting this out to you tonight. But that's the explanation for the tardiness. But my guest, who I'm very excited to have gotten the chance to talk to in detail, because despite the length of time that we've known each other, we haven't really sat down and had this kind of conversation, and we needed to. So let me tell you a little bit about Stephen here real quick. He hasn't had a chapbook or a poetry collection out yet, but he is a prolific poet. He does the a series on Eunoia Solstice, the website we have been attempting to run together for the last year or so. He's published all over the place, including the Washington Post, where he spent a week writing haiku for them. And done a number of other things, and as well as, you know, writing comic books, writing music. He's been in several bands, both experimental and bluegrassy. And so, well, you would know this if you had the third issue of the old Project for a New Mythology. Stephen was part of the Dolphin Street Sonic Arts Collective, who put the CD in with that rather elaborate third issue that we had way back in 2006. Wow. But big thing, part of the reason that I wanted to talk to Stephen and get this out to you is that he has been working on some comic books. And that comic book is set to be released in November. It's called, where did that email go? It's called Ghoulanoids. And he's doing that work with Daniel and Derek Ballard. Daniel Ballard happens to work with Jim Henson's daughter Heather sometimes at Ibex in Orlando, and Derek Ballard, he does work for Adventure Time, the cartoon series on Cartoon Network, and they've got a comic book coming out that'll be out in November. It'll make its debut at Comic Arts in Brooklyn, New York. So if you happen to be in the New York area, close to Brooklyn, and like comic cons and comic shows, go to check out Comic Arts in Brooklyn and look for Ghoulanoids. And that's something that that Stephen wrote and Derek did the artwork on and Daniel helped with. He's doing a if you go to a website that's linked to in the show notes, you'll be able to see some of the preliminary sculpts for the Ghoulanoids toys. And that comic book's coming out from Sacred Prism this fall, so you'll be able to check that out and get a hold of that. And that's why I wanted to talk to Stephen. So let's get right to my conversation here with Stephen McClurg. So how are things?
Things are good. You got there's a yelling in the living room now. Just various nap and feeding things happening. So
right. You've got two now, right?
Two, yeah. 6 month old roughly. Wow. Today. Well, 6 month old in 3 days. Yeah.
And that one's still fresh out of the wrapper, isn't it?
Yeah. Two and a half. Yeah.
Oh wow. Wow.
Yeah. So
always I have no ground with which to relate to that. I mean, I don't have children, but I'm impressed. It's that's a brave thing to do these days.
It's something. Yeah, it is work. It's great, and it's everything. Yeah, it's great, and it's weird, and it's wonderful, and all that. Yeah.
And wearisome, isn't it? I mean, you're up late a lot.
It can be. Yeah. Potty trading right now is wearisome. And wet and messy. It is all those things.
So
usually jump in. So are you recording?
Yeah. I hit.
Do I need a better mic or anything? Or I mean,
no. It sounds good. Sounds okay. Good.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right.
Awesome.
Yeah. Potty training is all that and more.
Yeah.
It's pretty nightmarish at this point.
Well, you know, if it ever happens for me, I'm going to call you for advice.
Well, please do. Well, a friend of ours is expecting now.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, hasn't made a big announcement yet, but yeah.
Oh, a mutual friend of ours.
A mutual friend of ours. Yeah, that should limit it very.
Okay, so.
One of the three of us. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I think I know who you're talking about. I'll send a note.
Yeah. So we've been talking about a lot of that. So, and he's younger than us. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Wow. How old are we? We're old.
We're older. Yeah, we're older than those younger folks.
So when do you head back to teaching?
Oh, we're doing it. I mean,
oh wow.
I don't have kids in class right now.
Yeah.
I have we do a lot of I'm going to dim the lights, give it more atmosphere so that the light isn't so shiny on my head.
Oh well.
Yeah, we're back. Today was an all day registration thing for me. And I worked a little bit during my lunch in the class, and tomorrow should be all classroom stuff and kids. I'll have kids in there on the 12th.
Well, tell you the truth, I was a little bit worried about you there for a minute because I figured you might have done like that teacher in Oklahoma. Did you hear about her?
No. What, recent?
Yeah, yesterday or today, but earlier this week, I saw it on Facebook. She showed up. It was just teachers there today, but apparently she showed up drunk and pantsless.
Awesome. I'm saving that for retirement.
Right.
Whenever the retirement comes through, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. Well,
I'm not there yet, though. I've got a few years before the whole retirement thing kind of is locked in, before I'm grandfathered in. So
right.
That, drunken pants.
Okay, Stephen, let's backtrack just a little bit. Sure. We've never actually met in person.
No, we haven't.
We found each other, I think, through like literary blogs online.
Yes.
As far back as would have been 2007, 2006, maybe.
Yeah, at least that. If not,
there's an easy way to
2006, somewhere around there. Yeah.
Actually, I can find out here real quick. So I've got the. Maybe not. Maybe the website won't let me. Yeah, back in the day. Sometime before, let's see. Oh, you're kidding me. I was that stupid. I didn't put a date on it.
I want to say.
Yeah, it had to have been maybe 2006, 2007, somewhere around in there.
I want to say the first poems. I want to say the first, like the poems that I had go into a project for a new mythology. I want to say that was 2005. And I know I was reading your blog before then.
Yeah. Yeah. It might have. Yeah.
Could Doesn't have that been. Sound quaint these days? Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
I still enjoy the blogs, but it seems like that's going the way of newspapers or a zine or something. I don't know.
I think, some weird connection between you and me and Brian Ferry. At least that's what I always seem to think there is, because I guess I encountered all of you online about the same time.
I was talking to a lot of folks in Minnesota for some reason at that time.
Yeah.
Jeff Herbach and Kelly Coyle and those folks.
Right.
And I think I was reading a lot of that stuff. And part of it was right about that time I had I was in grad school again and had kind of stopped playing music. And so I just I think collaboration was something that I didn't want to do as much of, or it had kind of crumbled in various ways. And so I had gone back to just writing because it was something that I could control. Mm-hmm. I knew would get done and get get out to people. So,
Right.
And there were Lit Six was the thing going on in Minnesota.
Right.
And there were several other literary blogs that I was really interested in. And,
That was kind of, that was the first kind of community that I stumbled across after I left Colorado and came back here to Kansas. Was literary blogs. And then they've kind of all just kind of dissipated and disappeared. There haven't been very many that I've,
I think a lot of them have started lit magazines, wink, wink.
Yeah.
Like that.
I think some of them are having a lot more success than we are. We're kind of dissipated at the moment. Now, you're not originally from Mississippi, are you?
No. And I've never...
Or Alabama. You're in Alabama.
I used to practice bluegrass in Mississippi, though.
Right. See, that's the problem, never meeting a person. I mean, geographically, I have no idea where you are half the time.
Actually, as I tell my students, I was born in a federal prison. I turned 21 seconds in prison. I was born in Fort Leavenworth.
How did that happen?
Well, my dad was actually an MP there.
Very
police officer there. So I was born in Kansas and lived there for a bit. And then we went to Germany and I lived there for a while when I was a kid. And I remember bits and bobs, nothing too striking. I ended up taking German my first time in grad school, I think. Wow. And then then came back and I lived in Michigan and Illinois. And then when I was about 11, I moved to Alabama, and I lived on an island in the Gulf of Mexico, and so it wasn't really like an Alabama experience, except I went to the high school that Bubba Gump is, Bubba Gump is from Bayou La Batre. I went to the high school in Bayou La Batre.
All right.
So, and then after that, I ended up moving to Mobile, and I've slowly, moved. When I moved to Birmingham, I had a few friends who were like, you're becoming a Yankee again because I moved to Birmingham. So yeah, it's been a kind of weird trajectory for as far as that goes. And I went to about five or six different elementary schools through.
Well, if your dad's moving around with the army, then yeah.
Yeah, that was part of it, and just. Yeah, various other reasons.
So what did your mom do if your dad was in an MP?
My family, so I know you like the origin story because I listened to the
podcast. Yeah. That's a good idea to kind of get a grasp on. Well, how do people become writers? Because I look back at my own family and it's like, okay, my dad wanted to be a psychologist, ended up a parole officer. My mom was a reader and she did some post-high school work with like an airline company attempting to be a stewardess, but that didn't work out.
She did some reading with the...
Well, she was a reader, and then after she did, she got a associate's degree in like communication from an airline school in Kansas City or something. I don't even know what that means either.
Like, it sounds cool though.
It was like she was studying to be a stewardess or something, and it
Wow, it's
didn't
like a
quite.
job that existed, you know, in the 70s and 80s and is gone now.
Right. And, but, you know, she was always a reader, you know, but there was no one was horribly creative or pushed people to be creative in my family. So it's like, where did this urge? You know, that's why kind of why I've been always been fascinated by the idea that writers share lesions on the side of their brains with temporal lobe epileptics.
Wow, okay.
Right? So I'm thinking that's got to be the only explanation because, you know, genetically, you
Yeah,
know,
it's
or
weird.
environmentally, growing up in a Western Kansas, where the hell did I get the idea to be a writer?
Yeah,
You know,
mine
I should have.
was similar, but my immediate family is no one went to college, and my dad was like a football guy, bodybuilder, boxer, was in the, you know, army, and then he was a DNR officer, which is like a Department of Natural Resources. It's kind of like a state police officer. They had the same jurisdiction, but they worked. His whole thing was like working in the fields and like, you know, dealing with poachers and like wild animals. Like we had cool this large like freezer on our back porch that always had evidence for court cases, but they were like, you know, mangled raccoon bodies and freezer bags and like half of a deer and like a skunk head and weird stuff like that because
This explains some of the work you showed me.
yeah, absolutely, yeah. You know, if there was a rabies case, like my dad would usually like have to go out and like shoot the animal and then like bring its head to our house and put it in the cooler. And of
Wow.
course, like, you know, I was always like, oh, I gotta go check that out. And he was always like, yeah, this is, you know, yeah, this is what I do. Now, my mom, I think, went to college maybe for a year. But she had me, you know, I was born when she was around 19 or 20. My parents were married already, and she worked odd jobs. She had a house cleaning business. She worked really odd jobs here and there. Going back to my grandparents, this is where like you'll see the like continuation of something. Like on one side, on my dad's side, which is where, well, actually I have like a lot of suicides in my family that have like trickled down through and you know got my dad, which is why I ended up in Alabama partially. But my grandparents on my dad's side were my grandpa on that side was like custodian. He ran like three different school. You know, he was always on the tractor, doing the lawn, doing like we would go in and he would be like, you know, doing the basketball court, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you know, as a mechanic and a gardener, did all that kind of thing. And my grandma on that side was a bus driver for the school. So I had that, and they were pretty wild. My great grandma on that side, which actually one of the poems that you had published is kind of about her. She was, you know, pretty wild. She's still alive. She's still going. She has Alzheimer's right now. And
How
thinks
old
that
is
I'm
she?
either my dad or my grandfather when I talk to her. But she's one of the greatest things. I got to dance with her to a bluegrass band at my wedding, and
Oh, that's nice.
it's one of the best memories I have because she was always, she would, we didn't know it, but she was like drinking. And part of the poem is about that. She was drinking NyQuil back in her room, but all we knew and all I knew as a kid was she would crank up like George Jones and Nitty Gritty Dirt Band and Johnny Cash.
Right.
And she would buck dance, and she would buck dance down the hall and grab one of us kids and dance. And one time she ended up pulling a knife on one of our friends of the family. And we found out that she was drinking a bunch of NyQuil back in the,
right.
the room. And so they had to pour that out. So I have like that kind of like, and her father used to shoot at airplanes that would fly over his farm.
Wow.
So the government, you know, doing whatever.
Had a conversation.
And so then the other side, like my grandparents on my mother's side, my grandmother was an accountant. And my grandfather was, still is, a Wesley scholar. He's getting ready to publish his third, like, textbook on John Wesley.
Wow.
And is, he's taught at college. He's taught, I mean, that side of my family had the library.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had everything. My grandpa would always buy like all the used books, and my grandmother read all the time.
Right, right.
And they had this massive library, and that's where, like, that's where everything was born for me. Was in, you know, it was just free access to whatever I wanted, and it
right, right.
had everything because he would just buy whatever was on sales table. He's like one of the Goodreads like reviewers, but he just reads anything and everything someone sends to him and reviews.
Right.
He's just
indiscriminate.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that's where I got a lot of it is from that part of my family, you know, the
right, right.
circuit riders and preachers. That's where I got the interest in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've occasionally tried to, you know, line it up with my mom's side of the family. Cause like I said, my mom was always a very, avid reader, but it was all romance novels. And her dad was a Lutheran minister.
Well, weird. That's the same thing with me. Like that's what they read now. They sit together. Like my grandpa, like that's, you know, my grandfather was a Methodist minister for a while. His father was a Methodist minister. His grandfather was a circuit rider who would ride, you know, horses to tents,
uh-huh.
give these revivals and all that.
Wow.
They read now, like all they read is like mystery novels. They read, they were the ones telling me about Twilight and like stuff like that. Like they just read all that stuff. And I'm like, I just, you know, I'm reading my grandpa's old books because like his
right.
old books are like Kierkegaard, Freud, that kind of stuff. And like I'm like, man, you like these are really great books. And he's like, oh yeah, those are good, those are classics, those are good, but like, you know, you should check out some of this other stuff. I'm like, well, sometimes, yeah. It's the same thing though. Like my mom is a reader. My mom reads
right.
how many books. I buy her books every Christmas. And what I try to find is like, what is the most literary mystery novel that like won awards or whatever that year,
right, right,
so that she'll read like other authors, because she'll just read like, you know, it's like, oh, B is for baseball bat or whatever, I'll read all those. Like she just gets into like one of those things and like just reads every one of them. And
uh-huh.
that's kind of how that side, my mom's side of the family, is like that too. Like they're like that now. It's the same thing, like just voracious readers, but just
right
whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Now my mother's at that point now where she's, if she reads, she falls asleep, so
oh.
I don't know how much reading she's doing anymore.
My mom still, you know, she finally, like, she even, like, I told her, I was like, Mom, you are the reader that like e-readers are made for, because she would
right.
buy, like, she only reads a book once, she won't reread it.
Mm-hmm.
And like her part of like the bookshelves in the library, it's just like, you know, these hundreds of books of like these just mystery novels, you know. And it's like, there's nothing wrong with mystery novels, but like, I was like, hey, why don't you read like the Sherlock Holmes stuff or Agatha Christie? Right. And she's like, nah, that's old. I don't want to, the murders aren't like bloody enough for that. And I'm like, okay,
right.
whatever. And, but she refuses to reread. So I'm right. like, just buy an e-reader. It's cheaper and you can buy, ton of these books and right, just read right. them on your e-reader, and then you don't have to deal with all these copies. And she's slowly like mm-hmm. doing that more now. And I mean, it's that kind of thing. Like, it's perfect for her. just buy all these weird mystery novels and like read them on your e-reader. And, she's doing that more. So, yeah.
So
funny.
With this library, what was it? Who were the first writers you discovered that really kind of, knocked you up the side of the head and thought, that's what I want to do. Who were your guys?
Oh boy. Yeah. There's so many phases of that.
We've got time.
I can talk about that. there's a really before my grandparents' library, the things that I was really locked into, and you can talk to people from Michigan and maybe Northern Ohio, and they're going to mm-hmm. say the same thing. There was this UHF station called Channel 50, and Channel 50 played like what I would basically say is like Quentin Tarantino's wet dream of a TV station.
Right.
And so like, every weekend I got up and I watched Godzilla movies, Kung Fu movies, like every genre you can think of. UHF uh-huh. played in Blackula. I love Blackula. Blackula is one of my favorite movies. And I wanted to be Blackula when I was a kid. I was just like, he's my hero. Like, I want to be Blackula. He was cool. I could go back and watch that movie. Like, he was so cool. But, along with all that,
is it on Netflix? I'll check it out.
It might be, but I mean, you can probably watch it on YouTube these days or something. Probably. But like, it has really early, like, it also has homosexual characters and stuff. Like, it's mm-hmm. pretty, it's just like, wow, there's these homosexual art dealers, which I mean, I guess is kind of a cliche now, but at the same time, it's like, wow, I just forgot this, like, when I rewatched it recently. But I mean, he was everything I wanted to be. He was cool. He had an afro. He was black. He was strong. He was, it was just like everything, like, he embodied just everything I wanted to be. And, but I mean, other than that, like, I just watched, it was genre stuff, just, mm-hmm. and the things that I really gravitated towards were especially like King Kong, Ray Harryhausen movies.
Right.
Those were stop motion animation is really, I mean, that, and then like really early, like the first things I remember especially are like Sesame Street and the Muppets and the Muppet Movie soundtrack, which is amazing. It's just a great record. So Jim Henson is really like Jim Henson, Ray Harryhausen were like these early, really early influences that I still go back to, still mm-hmm. love. I think they were great artists, like great American artists that are, I think they've won, a pretty good amount of accolades, but at the same time, they're not seen in right. the same light as like, they're not hip.
Right.
But they're, I think, as important as any other American artist. So those were like the early things. And then I was really into like the weird genre stuff. Mm-hmm. And when I sat down and read in my grandparents' library, the really young, this is like 8 or 9, I remember mm-hmm. reading Carl Sagan's Cosmos.
Really?
That was a really like in like some of his books, because I my grandpa had been a minister, but like he read everything.
Uh-huh.
And so that was a really important book to read, because it the thing that I got from it was like I became like basically an 8-year-old nihilist, because
an 8-year-old nihilist. Well, that has to be an interesting worldview right there.
Well, the thing was, is like he started talking about stars and like the life cycle of a star, and I'm like, well, our sun is a star. Oh my god. Like, it's either going to implode or explode, basically. You know, and rather than reading that in a very different way than I read it now, it very much, I read it as a very, like, nothing matters.
Right.
But along with that, I was reading, like, a lot of... because my grandpa studied psychology, uh-huh. also, he had all the serial killer stuff. So he had the Son of Sam, he had Helter Skelter.
I remember. I remember that, like, in the back bedroom, the guest bedroom at my mom's parents' house down in Muskogee, Oklahoma, used to scare the shit out of me. Because in the back bedroom,
you had the pictures of the crime, like in the right. middle, you had yeah. the photos of the crime scene,
the paperback of Helter Skelter. What it was. You know,
yeah, written in blood.
You, like, right. You walk into this house; it's all about light and Jesus and salvation. You go into the back bedroom where nobody goes. You know, it's just the right. kids. It's like murder.
He had every book on every like major serial killer, and
right.
I loved it. So I was like reading those, and those were like in the same bookshelf as like the shark books, and so. You know, I was reading all this stuff about like sharks. I was reading all this stuff about serial killers. I think this is like a thing boys go through.
Right.
It was like sharks, serial killers,
war.
Native Americans at one point. I was really yeah. like in the Sundance, like I watched A Man Called Horace or whatever.
Oh, right.
Where they
right.
show, yeah, they show the Sundance. So
With the exactly. with the hooks through his chest. The hook, oh, the hook yeah.
through his
oh,
chest.
God.
And I was like, this is the most amazing thing ever. And just obsessed with the, you know, like, this was a culture I could really get into. You know, I'm like third grade or whatever.
Right.
You know, this culture makes sense.
Right.
Because you're so brutal to each other whenever you're that young. And not that everything, I mean, and that's, oh, gosh, yeah, why I stepped into it. Can of worms there. Not that Native American culture is brutal, but I mean, you know, the Sundance is something like that went on daily at like elementary
right.
school.
Well, I mean, it's
like a special occasion. That was the norm.
Right. You kind of have to, take this idea of brutality and it has to be, I mean, outside of context in our, you know, modern, you know, Caucasian worldview, it does seem brutal, but it's not brutal in that context. That there's a rich history and tradition behind it. I mean, we can balk now at the whole human sacrifice in Mesoamerica, but there was something significant going on there. They built pyramids at the same time. There was,
it's
I mean,
John
there was,
in a Brave New World.
Yeah.
Why can't I be the one you sacrifice? Why, you know, he's basically saying, why can't I be Jesus? You know, why can't I be the scapegoat? Like, I need to be that figure. And it's beautiful in like a whole other way that you look at mm-hmm. it. So it's a really beautiful sense of it. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think having read Joseph Campbell, I think it comes from, you know, that kind of brutality is not what we call brutality is really the flip side of something else. In the culture and in its relation to the environment, to themselves, to the whole cycle of life and initiation.
Yeah, exactly. In terms of cycle of life, in life there's death, and death there's life.
And there's pain and there's sacrifice and all that stuff goes into it. And so, yeah, it seems brutal from one point, but it's just...
On the other side of it,
It's
part of the natural... order of things. It's mm-hmm. noble in some sense. It can be noble.
It's a way of reaching that understanding.
Not saying, you know, shooting rockets at children is noble. That's not
right. What I'm, well, no, I think that's hideous. Whether yeah. it's a
whoever it is,
high explosive or it's just a stone tip. I mean, if you're shooting at children, you're a little bit on the
exactly the different
side of something.
Is John in Brave New World wants to be. he wants to be, you know, he's willing to do that for the rest of the others. So it's a different thing.
Did you read that when you were young, Brave New World, or did that come along later?
That came later. I know I read that in high school. As far as like the stuff, so like that was like the beginnings of that. And then I remember like the first time I thought of like a writer as like a real person. Because otherwise they always seemed like, and I don't know if it's the blue collar aspect of it, but they always seemed, you know, almost godlike, like these people who are living these other lives. but the first person was Shel Silverstein, and that was
really?
Because he had, you know, the picture. If you go back and look at the picture on Where the Sidewalk Ends, I wrote it. There's an essay I did on this at the Drunken Odyssey. That picture, like, it just floored me. I was like, oh, wow, he's a person and he's written this stuff. And then from there it was, I don't know if Poe or Stephen King were first. I don't know which was first. One of them, and then they both happened, and then the Ramones happened soon after.
Now, how old were you when would you guess that you first discovered Shel Silverstein as the poet for like Where the Sidewalk Ends and A Light in the Attic and stuff like that? And how old were you when you realized that he got his start in Playboy?
Oh, that was later. Yeah.
Right.
Way later. Yeah. Yeah. Cause then he was like reading. Cause well, I mean, just the thing was, is like, all I had was like that. You know, I mean, when we were growing up, all you had was like that weird paragraph in the picture. Nothing else could look up unless you wanted to go look up, you know,
go well, to unless the, you wanted to go, to the library
and like look up the, you know, I didn't know how to use the, what is it, the
card catalog,
microfiche or micro or whatever. You know, I learned to do that stuff in grad school, but like when I was like 8 or whatever, I didn't know how to use the microfiche machine, so I wasn't about to go use that stuff. So like all we had was, there was no internet, so
the flap bio,
you had the flap, you had this photo, and like if you look at that photo on Where the Sidewalk Ends, it's the one where he's got the guitar and bare feet, and you know, and I always thought like his look, and of course I'm probably giving too much away, like he's bald and bearded, kind of menacing, you know, and I was like this is a guy, like he writes this stuff, like that's crazy, like you can do that, like that was probably like when I noticed him as a writer or author, it was probably as early as like second or third grade. Because he had a picture, like when you look at the Garfield books then, which were really popular in my elementary school, or even the Peanuts collections.
Yeah.
There's no author photo. You know, it's just the cartoon strip. So, you know, those almost seem like they're like given to you from wherever. But, you know, Shel Silverstein had the author photo. And so that was like, wow, there's a person doing this. I found out he lived at the Playboy Mansion, like probably like college or post college. It was a long time later, you know.
Oh, jeez, that's probably a good thing.
Because
I think I was still somewhere in grade school, and my dad was a big collector of the Playboy magazines.
Oh, wow!
And once I started to, you know, take an interest in naked ladies.
Secret stash.
I found the secret stash, and I would come across these old issues.
House, because was it actually in your house? The secret stash. So he was a Playboy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Dad was a Playboy reader. I mean, there was always the current issue was always on the back of the toilet.
Wow, just that accessible.
Oh yeah. Well, hell, I've got we have a picture in the family photo album. My dad laying on the couch, you know, reading a Playboy, holding it up. And I am like 3-4 years old, fresh out of the bath, you know, still leaning on my towel, butt naked, leaning over his shoulder.
Yeah, checking it out.
Checking out Playboy over his shoulder. Sure. Right?
Like, you know, I'm hungry.
Yeah, what's that? You know, so it was always out there and around or whatever. And wow, when parents were out of the house, I knew where to go and find them. And so I was, you know.
70s. Was it the 70s?
70s, early 80s, you know.
Yeah, yeah, great.
Yeah, we're both about the same age. I'm 42.
I'm 30, late 30s. So.
Yeah, you don't want to be specific.
Same. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, so.
My student's guessing.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd find the old Playboy like from 1960 something. And there would be this piece in there. It'd be go, Shel Silverstein. But they just read me that poem in class the other day. And I'd be like, I know something nobody else knows.
Wow. So you were early. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was.
I always found secret stashes. I found were always weird stashes like out in the woods or something.
Right. You know?
Like where you're building a tree for it.
Right, right.
Like, oh man, this would be a great roof. And you grab a piece of like plywood and you're like, what?
Yeah. 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 Those would be the porn like, trolls that Mark Maron talks about.
Yeah. So it was much more foreign to me. The serial killer. That was comforting and close. That I could relate to.
Right.
Oh, so I think him. Yeah. John Wayne Gacy. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I remember one of my high school papers. All of my high school research papers were either on serial killers. School in Alabama. So I know my teachers were like, oh my God, what is wrong with this guy? They were either on serial killers, Edgar Allan Poe, or the blues.
Right.
Those were the three topics. And then one topic I did was a comparison between Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. That was like my senior project after all the serial killers and the blues. Like, I'll go back to ancient Greece and like refresh some on that. But like, what I would always do is from my title page, I would always draw something elaborate. Like, and like, it's the thing that I ignore as a teacher, like, oh, mm-hmm. Whatever. Like, did you actually write anything? But like, I did, you know, the John Wayne Gacy Pogo the Clown.
Oh, God.
One of my title pages was like I redrew like the entire like Pogo the Clown paint from John Wayne Gacy. I know my teachers were just like, Jesus, I can't wait. Yeah, pass this guy. Like, I can't.
Don't keep him around. Give his name to the cops just in case.
But wow. His influences. You know, Stephen King was obviously like a really early mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, me too.
And I still think like his nonfiction is so good and so underrated.
Mm-hmm.
Dance Macabre or Macabre.
Right.
Whatever, however you say that word.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, I've heard it so many different ways. His analysis of horror and culture is so good that right. I really just want to, I was like, please like update this. Like if you've kept up with it or like talk to your sons or whatever, like, I would love for him to update that book. It's an incredible book. It's a really, really, great book. And I mean, I like his fiction too, but his, in fact, like the movie Running Man, I don't know how many people are watching that these days, but it came up on Netflix recently. And I watched that and I was like, wow, this is the Hunger Games. And it's really, really good. So like, it was way better than I thought it was, surprisingly.
Yeah, but the book and the movie are so wildly different.
It's been so long. It's been so long. I mean, I know the endings, like the ending of the book has always stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
But getting to that ending, I don't remember very well. But just watching the movie, I was like, wow, this is the Hunger Games, and like all the dystopian stuff we're seeing now that's very popular. It's the
All
same
comes
thing.
from that, yeah. Right. That's the thing about Stephen King. I think we've talked about this before, emails or whatever, that he's just so, or maybe about other people or other emails or whatever, but he's just so uneven at times in the fiction. There's just some stuff that's,
Stephen King, like
yeah.
it's the connection is really like fading out for me.
Oh, so I was saying that with Stephen King, the thing is that, you know, he's very uneven. You still having problems? Uh-oh.
Yeah, I can't hear you.
Okay. Can't hear me at all still.
I can hear you now, yeah.
Okay. I wonder if it's if I bumped the microphone or did something.
Everything went like 8-bit on this end. The picture went 8-bit and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's our connection.
Oh,
Probably
that's okay.
sucks.
Are we good now? I guess not. From the look on your face there, we're not.
I'm trying to move around the room here. Now I can't hear anything.
Oh, well. Want to reset the. Let me see if I can get to a. Gonna type in a
All
message here. Want to. Can you hear me now?
wonder if we need to reset.
All right.
Is it
As long as we can hear each other, I think we're cool.
okay? Yeah, it's oddly frozen on a picture of you that's very 8-bit.
Oh, that's right. You probably hit the audio call only and rather than the video conference, but
Well,
that's cool.
it's video, but it's changing very slowly, and
Oh.
I don't see myself anymore, but that's I'm okay with that.
Okay, yeah, like I said, as long as we can hear each other, that's really all that matters, because nobody on the podcast is going to see anything.
Exactly.
No,
But I have a face for radio.
yeah, me too. where were we? We were on Stephen King.
Yeah, I mean, he was I remember particularly sixth grade. One of the first things that I had written was I wrote for our like school newspaper. We had like this newspaper. And I did a movie review for Halloween, and I reviewed Halloween, Creepshow, The Shining. You know, this is
Oh,
sixth
wow.
grade. I'd
Right.
already seen all these movies. And I even drew like little pumpkins, so I rated them in like, you know, instead of stars, pumpkins. They recreated that all on this handout, and
Wow.
yeah, it all got censored. I was like, wow, my first
God.
work, you know, got censored. Because they were like, all the movies you reviewed were R-rated. And so for sixth grade, that just wasn't going to work.
Doesn't fit, yeah. No, okay. Yeah, no, that was the thing that always kind of when I got to the point, well, I grew up out in Dodge City, Kansas, so I never really most of my reading was, you know, my mother's books on the shelves, a lot of World War II books, like the Time Life books on World War II, and then stuff from the Scholastic Reader Program, you know, that brochure you'd get in grade school. So my reading was always just, it was never quite what I was really interested in, you know, except for war. Then, you know, and got into high school eventually and discovered Stephen King and things like that. And you have a strange look on your face.
I'm probably going to have to brave the office
Okay.
for connection reasons.
But yeah, I mean, got to high school and discovered Stephen King, and it was, you know, it hit that spot, kind of that interesting, dark, mysterious. You get something different, and it was not what the teachers wanted you to read. Right?
Sorry, I'm having like weird connection things.
Oh, that's all right. That's right.
Yeah. I heard some of that you were in high school reading Stephen King.
Stephen King. You know, it was kind of the first real release into adult literature and being able to read stuff that I wanted to read, and it wasn't really until I got to college and finally figured out what it was that, you know, how you could determine good literature from bad literature, that I really kind of began to discover that Stephen King is uneven.
Oh, okay.
At best, you know, some books are really, really good and some are just, you know, horrible. He's a bit like Philip Dick, who, you know, some books are really good. Like, you know, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep is fabulous. And then you've got other stuff that's just like, you stop, the last page is just, you know?
I haven't read a lot of, you know, I've read the Dick stuff. I've been reading that in chronological order of the novels. Mm-hmm. And before that, I read a bunch of the short stories, like the collected or the selected short stories. Mm-hmm. I don't remember which, or like, it was the collected volume one or something like that.
Right.
And you could see a definite progression in his writing style throughout those. I mean, he was cranking stuff out, but like just mad with ideas.
Right. You
know? Like just overflowing with ideas. Incredible in so many ways. And his novels, I've just really loved as I've been reading them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's this pulp, you know, there's that pulp aspect to his stuff,
right?
Where he's cranking it out. With Stephen King, you know, I felt that here and there. I'm trying to think of, like, I remember, like, around the time of, man, I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was the novel that was about like a shop, and it had and they made a mini series out of it. But that it? Like Gerald's Game, those was later. It was around that time. I've got it somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
But like,
yeah, it's the one where the.
I remember around that time feeling that element of, yeah, this isn't as strong as it was. I mean, the early short stories are mm-hmm. like really fun because they're all like jokes, like punchlines.
Right.
I always thought they were a lot of fun. But yeah, his nonfiction, I think, is just tremendous. So I remember in middle school, he was definitely someone. And so then from there was like the big horror boom.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember I was reading Robert R. McCammon, who's from Birmingham. And I've met him, Clive Barker,
right.
Dean Koontz.
Uh-huh.
I was reading a lot of the horror stuff that was coming out. George R. R. Martin, like oddly, like when I was 14, I remember reading, it was called The Skin Trade, I think. And it was a book of werewolf stories. Huh. And it had George R. R. Martin and Stephen King. And I don't remember who the other authors were. There were like two right. or three other authors. And it was a collection of like three or four novellas.
Hmm.
And that was where I first read George R. R. Martin. And I was like, man, this werewolf story he wrote is so great. I remember copied like certain little details.
Right.
Our like ninth grade English teacher had us write these stories. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've got to use, you know, these elements of that. And, So I remember that being like an early sense of like looking at an author's style. And I know Poe was someone that I looked at a lot for style. And I won like a Stephen King horror award when I was in high school. But I don't remember. It may have been for that werewolf story or something. Right. I don't remember what it was for.
Huh.
And I used to win, you know, I would write these poems and stuff and I would win awards. But right. like, you know, my class had like 100 people in it. So I don't, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't know what that means, you know.
Who knows? I mean, my class did.
Yeah, I was interested in all that stuff. When I got to college, the stuff that like blew me away, it was Emily Dickinson.
Uh-huh. Right.
Robert Frost, Samuel Beckett, James Joyce. I really got into Georgia O'Keeffe and Frida Kahlo mm-hmm. as artists, but Kiki Smith was another one that I really liked. Right. But as far as writers, like,
well, you're a bit of a triple threat. I mean, you write, you draw, you have a visual element and music, so you're dangerous.
Yeah, I scribble, doodle, and noodle. Yeah, I've really felt that, you know, the I guess the Russian version of the proverb is chase two rabbits, catch none.
Mm-hmm.
I've really felt that.
Well, you know, there's got to be a way to tie them all together. And I think to a certain extent, you know, when you did some work for Project for a New Mythology, we managed to get close to knitting them together, because in that third issue, we had the graphic story that you wrote with I can't remember his name right now. It's top of my head. I don't know if I still have it up.
Yeah, my connection's so bad at this point, like I can't hear anything.
Oh, really? Okay, I'll try and get...
We have a terrible connection here.
Okay.
I'm trying. Can you hear me?
Yeah, oh yeah, I can hear you perfectly.
Yours is all broken.
Hmm. I wonder what...
Alabama. Yeah, I'm going to try it without the video for now. Like, I have no video now, but...
That's cool. I don't have any either, so I think we'll... Maybe if we just limit the bandwidth, who knows?
Yeah, maybe that'll work better. Like, it's terrible in this neighborhood, man. It's at times. It's really...
Yeah.
It's the worst internet service I've had since, like, AOL or whatever.
Wow. What do you have there? Who's the provider?
What is it, like Comcast or one of those? Like, I don't have cable, but I have like internet. So,
mm-hmm.
Something wow. like that. So, yeah, sorry. Like, and we're
no, no.
getting into all this like good stuff about Stephen King, because he's come up a lot on the podcast, and he's also come up a lot on the Drunken Odyssey. I don't know how many people listen to that or
right.
are interested into it, but it's another writing podcast. And, yeah, I mean, he was the first, you know, besides Poe and Silverstein, he was like the first guy that I was paying attention to as a writer, you know.
Right.
And so that meant a lot. And then whenever I went to college, the thing with Emily Dickinson and Samuel Beckett was that I didn't understand what they were doing. And mm-hmm. I had already, like, I had a profound love for David Lynch and things like that.
Right.
And kind of, like, weird or stop-motion animation, avant-garde cinema. And so when I read Emily Dickinson and Samuel Beckett, it was, like, that same experience of that kind of cinema. And right. that just, like, it was like, man, I just don't want to, you know. there's nothing else in the world that's like this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's kind of, you know, when I was always obsessed with story. I mean, it kind of always was my thing. And you tell a good story, I'll be hooked on it. Which I think was what drew me into Stephen King. And I think when I got dissatisfied with him before I even really knew it was kind of that inattention to the language. Yeah. And when I got to college and stuff like that.
He's a friend and our mutual friend, Eric.
Yep.
Not that I'm giving too much away.
No.
We've been threatening. We're reading a lot of stuff together. We always do like a reading kind of thing together. And we're finishing up War and Peace right now.
Oh, wow.
We're reading the entire Bible together and Plato and Burke together. So, like, we're always kind of in it for the long haul. And we just read, we read all of Vonnegut's novels, and then we read all of Hemingway's novels together. And so one of the things that we've threatened is like this group of like fiction writers, their poetry, like reading, because it's so bad. Stephen King's poetry is really bad. Ray Bradbury's poetry is really bad.
Yeah.
Faulkner's poetry is bad. Hemingway's poetry is bad. Like James Joyce's poetry is bad. Like,
yeah,
all those guys, like their poetry is bad. And I mean, of course, they're like some of the greatest writers ever.
Right. Right.
But like, yeah, they like a lot of them when, you know, I think part of that was just that at that time, you know, poetry was the dominant, you know, it was the masculine post, like, you know, Tennyson kind of, you know, post, you know, Eliot.
Right.
Pound. It was the dominant masculine form of writing, you know. Mm-hmm. Novels were for scribbling women. And so we've always threatened to like do like a reading group based on like all these authors, like awful poetry. I don't know where I was going with that, by the way.
Well, I think I brought up the inattention of inattention to language.
There you go.
Stephen King.
Aspect, yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing is that I think what I...
The Shining is still a brilliant novel.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
And he really, like... And I'll still defend him in certain ways on so many accounts, like...
Right.
Dude is a great writer. He is a great writer. He deserves like whatever award or whatever. Like people were protesting awards.
What was it? That Lifetime Achievement or Champion of Literature Award?
Too, because they put in like Shirley Jackson, H.P. Lovecraft, Philip K. Dick, and Stephen King. Like there was a bunch of like folks who were considered kind of genre that were all going
right.
Like all those people deserve whatever they get because they were great. Like they, H.P. Lovecraft, his style is stilted and stuff, but like, we're still dealing with what he wrote.
Right. Right.
And Shirley Jackson is totally underrated. Amazing writer. Dick, I think, is still not dealt with in the way that I've been reading Stanislaw Lem. He wrote the original Solaris, and he wrote a magnificent book called A Perfect Vacuum. Him. And then, you know, like all these folks were winning all these awards and like people got like real stuffy and weird about it. But like, they're great writers, you know? I mean, they're as weird. I mean, it's as weird as reading Samuel Beckett, you know, Beckett, but like to me, like Beckett, like as much as people want to talk about Beckett is absurdism and all that, like to me, Beckett is totally real life. Like to me, Beckett is more realist than almost in a sense Tolstoy. Now that's, I sound like an asshole saying something like that.
That's kind of my stock in trade, is just say something obnoxiously out there and get people talking about it.
Well, that's what I always liked about your blogs, was that it's about something, and they were always about like issues that were out there in publishing and writing, and issues that were bigger than like just like, oh man, I ate these really great fish tacos the other day, which, you know, like so much stuff has kind of descended into.
Yeah.
But yeah, Beckett to me has always been a realist.
Mm-hmm.
Extreme humor, extreme dismay.
Yeah.
But like all beautiful. To me,
right.
I don't know. He's just the writer that, like, in college, him and Emily Dickinson were the two that, like,
yeah,
I just really connected with, like, that's the stuff, you know.
Yeah, strangely, I connected with Hemingway off the bat, and when I was an undergrad.
Yeah.
And who else? I think Hemingway primarily.
Oh, okay.
As far as the ones that, as the writers that were taught in class, and
well, see, yeah.
And that's the thing, is that there's different ways to be inattentive towards language in prose, and I think it reflects and comes out differently. I mean, the inattentiveness that Stephen King always had for me was this ability to rely on certain kinds of emotional shorthand.
Yeah. The thing is like, you're never going to get a better like cultural analysis of like late 70s, 80s life.
Right.
Than Stephen King's works. I mean, The Shining, like I was trying to, and I just never found the time to do it, but I was supposed to write an essay for The Drunken Odyssey on The Shining, like once as a horror novel, because The Shining is the only novel that's ever scared me.
Really?
Seriously scared me. And it was The Woman in the Tub. And then beyond that, you know, it's a book about alcoholism. It's
right.
A book about the sins of the fathers. It's everything that time was. You know, he really had like such a to use the awful expression, the finger on the pulse of the time. You know, he really had it at that time. I think it's a brilliant novel. I think it's a really great novel. It's not about like all the creatures and like the house and like all that stuff.
Right.
It's about like child abuse and divorce. It's about all of those things in American culture at the time.
Right. Yeah, I'll go back and read that one.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think it's a great novel. I mean, Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House. I mean,
yeah,
incredible. Yeah. Incredible novel. Just, you know.
Well, you know, it's... You know, Hemingway couldn't write poetry, but he could write great prose.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then
the thing is he didn't write just like shitty, like the idea of him like writing like these short declarative sentences. Like the dude could write like a page sentence when he had to. And
yeah,
he did that often in his nonfiction. Like Hemingway's nonfiction. You know, and of course you can argue like whatever about nonfiction and all that crap, but I mean, whatever. Like Hemingway was a great writer. Great writer. And like A Movable Feast, like I don't know many people who write that don't say like that's one of their favorite books.
Maybe I should actually read that one.
My God,
I've been putting it off.
Oh, dude, you gotta read it. Like you gotta read, like there's two versions of it now.
Right.
And, oh, Jesus. Yeah, you gotta read it. It's incredible. Like Midnight in Paris, you know, the Woody Allen movie. Have you seen that?
Right. Yeah.
Oh, you've seen that. Okay, great. Like that's based basically on Oh no, you've got to read it. It's incredible. It's like
Yeah.
him being nervous because he's in the same room that James Joyce is in. It's like
Really?
Ezra Pound walking around. It's like him in the same room, like him having discussions about art and philosophy with Gertrude Stein.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Now,
It's just, oh, you got to read it. You got
I
to.
have to admit that's probably one of my weaknesses is reading the nonfiction of novelists, because I've blown through a lot of Hemingway's novels, the short stories, most of
You
Hemingway's
haven't
novels, the
read,
short stories.
have you read Green Hills? Or have you
Yes.
read, okay, if you have read Green Hill, have you read the bullfighting novel,
This Death in the Afternoon.
Death in the Afternoon? Yeah.
No,
Gotta
no.
read them. They're great.
Those I haven't gotten around to. I went through my little arc with Hemingway, The Sun
Really?
Also Rises, Farewell to Arms, For Whom the Bell Tolls, The Old Man and
Now,
the
see,
Sea,
like, how do you feel
A
I'm
River
about
Run,
his novels?
about Hemingway's
Because
novels?
someone I know had like reviews that compared their novel to Hemingway, and it wasn't me.
Well,
But I think it, like, in also, like, in total, like, I think it was totally like warranted.
well,
I think you like Evolution of Shadows
Tony,
was it? I know. Shut up. Like, it was. I'm so happy. Like, I was so nervous reading that book when I ordered it because I was like, God, if I don't like this book, like, things are gonna be really weird. And I read it and I was like, holy crap. Like, the only complaint I had was like, I wish he would have left less things about shadows in the book. That was my only
Well,
complaint, because I was like, I get
every
it.
novel is flawed, and I'm
Sure,
flawed,
yeah. I
and
mean, it's like everything, everything is flawed. It's because we're crapping on it. But I was like, this novel is so good. Like, and then I started looking at reviews of it, and I was like, yeah, man, it deserves. I was really, and that's what made me like pursue more of the stuff that we've been doing, So, I don't say that lightly, in any way, but Hemingway's later writings are so good.
Right.
And it's like people don't. I was so happy because I was doing music for a while for a Drunken Odyssey, like their podcast. And I just couldn't keep up with, like, I just couldn't, with kids and teaching
Right.
and all that. Like, I just couldn't. I was so excited to do, like he was willing to have me, like, do weird music every week behind the essays that were turned in. I was
Right.
super excited about that, but I just, like, I couldn't, I just physically couldn't do it. But one of the essays was one that was by a Hemingway scholar, and I'd already read like all of his works in chronology, and
Wow.
it's just, it's beautiful work. Like, you sit down,
Yeah.
it's like he wrote like paragraph long sentences.
Yeah.
It's none of that like short declarative, like, yeah,
Right. All the cliched stories about him,
exactly. Like,
you
that's
know,
the thing.
and
Like, it's been, whenever I sit down and I read an author's work from beginning to end, like, I see where like the author themselves destroyed all the cliches
right.
that are offered up as like shorthands for their career.
Yeah. When I was starting out, though, the thing was I already knew, probably on some level, that I had the potential to be entirely delusional about what it meant to be a writer.
I'm
You know,
sorry. Yeah.
right?
We're putting underwear on a child right
That's all right. You know, but that, you know, so
I've
there
got
was.
like a half naked simian.
Oh, the video's not working, so I can't
Yeah,
see.
I know, staring at me like she's just looking at me with a pacifier and like
Are you gonna do this thing or not?
putting
Come
on
on.
underwear and like staring at me and like, I know. This is always humbling. Like, children are the most humbling. Like, it's amazing.
Right.
It really is everything people say it is, but then, yeah, you know. God. We're talking about, you know, artistic, avoid high artistic style.
Right, and we're changing diapers.
While, like, I'm putting underwear on a human being. It's just warm. But that's Beckett. To me, like, Beckett already, like, he said all that. Like, that's exactly what human life is like.
Right. Yeah, I just didn't want to read the nonfiction because I knew that I was never going to be able to go to and live in the Paris that Hemingway lived in.
Oh, it's amazing.
So I didn't want to torture myself with it.
Probably totally not real.
Right. But... So it was more important to me to read the fiction and figure out how the fiction worked.
Do you like the later fiction? Like, what were your favorites of Hemingway?
I think my favorites of Hemingway are The Sun Also Rises and The Old Man and the Sea.
Okay, so like first, all of his stuff in order. Like, I'll say the short stories are, like God's gift to other writers. His short stories are, I mean, what do you think about the short stories?
Oh, I love them. But I, you know, I also want to throw in like Raymond Carver.
Oh yeah. And, yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. But just,
and like, John Cheever in on with Hemingway. Oh, yeah, this continuum,
like,
but
ignoring other people, like Hemingway short stories are absolutely incredible.
Right.
Amazing works. There's no doubt. Like, whether you see like feminism, you want to read them as Marxism, whatever, like, his short stories are incredible. Yeah. On top of that, the nonfiction for me is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, for me, you know, like, it's funny you mentioned The Sun Also Rises, because like, he talked about The Sun Also Rises. He wanted to create a kind of rhythm of the Bible. You know, he wanted to create a rhythm of why is this? Yeah, like, you know, King James Bible, where he builds a sentence on a sentence on a sentence. Right. And to me, he doesn't really achieve that until, like you said, The Old Man and the Sea.
Right.
And if you read The Old Man and the Sea, yes, okay, there's some symbolism that is just like right on the nose.
Right.
But other than that, the writing in that is so condensed and so immediately brilliant and beautiful. Like,
right.
I just like, how do you like whatever, you know, whatever right. people want to say about it. Like, the Old Man and the Sea is brilliantly beautiful.
Right.
For
it's
me,
precise and it's unsentimental.
Exactly. And he achieves the rhythm to me of the King James Bible. Finally. In The Old Man and the Sea, which was like his goal, part of his, he had like two goals with The Sun Also Rises, and it was to redeem the generation, and it was also to like recreate this King James rhythm.
Right.
I don't think he really does that until Old Man and the Sea. That's my own personal view.
Yeah.
Well,
I always have soft spots for first novels by writers because you kind of get,
oh, it's dirty. It's
right.
It's great because
it's that moment of discovery. You get to see
exactly
everything that they were trying, that they've, you get to see what they still haven't overcome.
I will
what
say,
they did overcome. You get to see that little first spark of self-awareness, almost.
One of the few creative writing classes I took was one that was really horrible. But what the writer did in that class was made me aware of like first novels and how clunky they were.
Mm-hmm.
and like to look at first novels and to like really think about like, well, what does this writer do? Because we were all young writers in the workshop and stuff.
Right.
And I was like, oh, wow. You know, it took me years later. I mean, for a long time, I just thought he was like a jerk ass. But he really made me look at that differently. But mm-hmm. Yeah, my favorite novels by him or by Hemingway are, I think For Whom the Bell Tolls is where he really achieves the military novel that he right. always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has the military aspect, but it also has all of the aspect of full personhood, full right. humanity. It has clunk, you know, it has
mm-hmm.
problems when he does, was it frickin' fudgin', whatever, you know, he inserts all this stuff for swearing. It's
oh, first, right, right.
And yeah. then whenever, he does, he attempts to insert, you know, so like in English, you know, thou was right. familiar.
Right. And so, he was trying to mimic Spanish without exactly. writing in Spanish.
And, mimic just Spanish. Kind of... and like, so there's a logical reason for what he does, but the problem is
it doesn't work.
It comes out as like, you're trying to be a jerk ass. So it comes out like heavy, where
right.
in the Spanish it was meant to be familiar. It comes out as formal
right.
in English. And it's like, oh man, like, it's like, I know what you were going for, but
it's not working.
You know, it just misses. But still, overall, the novel of For Whom the Bell Tolls, amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Oh, I agree.
Old Man in the Sea, he finally achieves the rhythm and.
Yeah,
the narrative power of mythology and really like speaking in the King James Bible.
Right, right.
Which he had tried to do with his first novel, and I think he failed. And I don't think he really succeeded until Old Man in the Sea.
Right.
Because to me, it's like, that's a mythic story. It's not like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one I really like is... what is it? Through the woods or over the woods and
across the river
across
and
the river.
Through the trees.
Yeah, it's like
into the trees or something.
Like that. Yeah, Andrew Jackson's last words are the title. And in that, the character, the military character that he's carried out throughout his whole career is retiring.
Yeah.
And he's at his last moments and he's doing his last tour through Europe. And there are some moments in that book that are just like, I literally like typed out chapters of that book.
Huh. Really? Because
I thought they were so beautiful because it was like him recognizing his age, him recognizing like where he
right.
was in his lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And also dealing with that mercenary character, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder if the reason that didn't ring with me is just a, you know, the mental state age thing. One of the things that I've always noticed is that if
it didn't ring with a lot of people, like it's to me like Across the River and Through the Trees is mm-hmm. like oh hell.
Well, it's an old man's novel. It's not
exactly. It's beautiful. It's like not Cat's Cradle by Vonnegut, but the earlier novel
I don't know Vonnegut.
Let me look.
Yeah, I mean, I hold to this theory that you know, it's novels. They're always. Sometimes you're ready mentally. Your brain is ready for a certain novel, and sometimes it's not. And I had that experience when I first tried reading The Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie. I could not get into it. Couldn't get into it. Put it aside for a few weeks, came back to it, everything clicked. Lawrence Durrell's...
I read that one after college, so it was like right there.
Right.
And
I tried reading it when I was 16, so...
I can imagine that was a tough one.
Well, and Lawrence Durrell's set of books, the Alexandria Quartet... I started reading Justine, which is the first book in that four book cycle. And at first I just could not get into it. It wasn't clicking. I didn't quite understand what was going on. You know, I put it aside for a couple of months, came back to it, and everything snapped into place. My brain was ready for what he was laying down, and I read through all four books in a month.
Oh,
I
awesome.
Burned through that thing. I loved that of books.
Yeah, I just remembered Mother Night.
Mother Night. Okay.
So for me, Across the River and Through the Trees, I consider it like a sleeper novel.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that Mother Night is for Vonnegut.
Okay.
Mother Night to me is like his second best novel after Slaughterhouse-Five. Okay. It's his literary novel, the same way I think of Across the River and Through the Trees. It's like mm-hmm. his literary novel. Beautiful, quiet to
right.
some extent. I love the both of those works. Yeah, a lot. Okay.
Maybe I'll go back and give that one another try. But yeah.
I copied out one of the chapters, like the entire thing. It's when he goes to the Venice food market and is talking about just the food that's laid out before him. And it's just brilliant, you know. It's just like, I mean, because he, you know, one of the things that Hemingway could do is, it's funny, like one of the teachers that I've taught with, it was like, you know, thank God Hemingway didn't live now, like where there's like meth and crack and like that kind of stuff. Because, I mean, he really like he goes to this market. And he describes the sausage and the ducks and like everything to this like nth degree. And it's just like this. It's just, you know, it's beautiful. You know, it's
right.
Wonderful, you know. But at the same time, the whole time the character is acknowledging, you know, his own death. Like the whole purpose
right.
of the book is like it's about this character's demise. So this acknowledgement of this life and death and life, you know, is very much like a Campbellian kind of thing, you know, Campbellian
right.
Jesus. You can just edit all that out, you know. What am I talking about?
Who knows? You just let it go, man. Let it rip. I don't care. The brain works.
Yeah.
And
I think sometimes I sound like an idiot, but
well,
yeah, no, it's just that that life cycle thing. You know, he's
yeah,
they, like he's really synced into that. You know.
Are you reading now? Who are the people that you're touching on and gravitating towards now?
Oh man, it gets awkward. it's just I read so strangely. Maybe not strangely, just like
Well, if you read with any order, you'd be boring.
Yeah, it's I really don't do that. I'm reading like I'm really obsessed with lists, and I know lists are meaningless, but at the same time, I don't know if it's like growing up blue collar, like, oh, these lists, like if I read everything on this list, I think there's like a certain aspect. It's the same way like my dad died. I mean, he killed himself when I was 10. So
wow.
I think at the same time, like the way I've always been looking for like, male figures in my life. And he didn't spend a lot of time at home. He was always working, you know,
right.
younger. I think it's the same thing. Like I've always been looking for, you know, searching. And so it's the same way. Like I'm always reading like a stupid amount of books at one time. And, like right now I'm reading War and Peace. And it's incredible, like everything that everyone's ever said about it. Yeah, it's amazing. I'm reading a tarot bang to collected poems, or the first book by a young a young poet named Jessica Piazza. She won an award. And so, like, I read one or two of those a day. I'm reading the entire Bible. And I read like a verse or two a day. I mean,
Wow.
it's just a weird mix of things. Alan Moore's Swamp Thing, I'm trying to get through and like buy, but like buy in hardcover because it's so good. Stanislaw Lem and Philip K. Dick, I started last year. I was reading them in order. I started reading Salman Rushdie in order.
Right.
I've been rereading Stephen King in order, and I'm only up to The Dead Zone.
How do you fit all that in there?
I
Because
don't like I
I'm
don't
struggling.
yeah I you know I've really embraced audiobooks
I see.
and a lot of like current fiction because I like to give my students a lot of times they want to read something that's current because they don't want to like they're not interested in. Well, they say they're not interested. They eventually become interested. Initially,
Right.
they're not interested, like if I assign something old. So I try to assign like and keep up with like current fiction. And also like because I write, I want to keep up with, what's out there. And so I found like audiobooks are just amazing. And I can, I've easily upped the amount of reading I do by like one or two books a week.
Wow.
And so right now I'm reading Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer, which could easily like if I like it, could easily end up like a summer reading possibility for
Yeah.
myself next year.
Wow. I couldn't do it. I don't hate it. I have a hard time being read to. I go to readings and I really have to
I wasn't
work to
until
concentrate.
maybe 2 years ago, and I talked to our librarian at our school, and she was like, "Oh, I love audiobooks." And I was like, "Really? I think I'd hate them." And it's, I mean, some are better than others, but it's like I have no, like, I never get angry driving anymore because I'm so into the story going on, and it's really allowed me to read. Because a lot of times when I'm teaching, I'm reading a lot of classics and I'm thinking about classics and I'm thinking about poetry and other things. So really like listening to audiobooks has really allowed me to like read a lot of contemporary fiction, like Jennifer Egan, David Sedaris. And really like I think the way to like read a David Sedaris book is just like get the audiobook. He's an amazing reader, I
Yeah,
mean,
he is.
it's just like I started reading one of his books and I was like, I think I'm gonna wait or either just buy the audiobook, like I just like it's almost like hard to do not hearing his voice read those things.
Yeah,
It totally turned me around to audiobooks. And the way I real like, yeah, there's going to be moments where you like flake out or like you're thinking about other things. But I mean, we do that when we normally read. If there's a long like 2-page paragraph
True.
in a Faulkner novel, we're gonna catch most of it. But like we're gonna, you're gonna sink out of it or whatever. You know what I mean? Like I mean,
You're gonna skip the conjunctions.
exactly. Like there are going to
Yeah.
be moments where you kind of slip out of it. And so that's all I like associate with the audiobooks. Yeah, I really, really, really like them now.
Okay, a couple of things,
Sure.
real quick. Now,
Real quick.
we've been real quick. We've been swapping messages for a while. You had said that you were working on a graphic novel with someone. Is that correct?
Well,
Or something like that you
I've
were
been,
doing?
yeah. So, in 2012, when my first daughter was born, I was like, okay, what are you going to do? I was playing in a really great band, a band that I loved playing with. And it was like, I just don't have time for that. Like, I can't make practices. I
Right.
just can't do it anymore. So, like, what are you going to do? And that was really right about the time that I contacted you about, you know, a solstice and all that. Like, so I just decided, like, okay, one of the things I can do on my own is write.
Right.
And so since about 2000, I mean, and I've done this at various points. I mean, I've been writing. My first published writings were like I said, like in sixth grade. So I've always liked writing. I've always enjoyed doing it. And I've done it on and off for pay since, I mean, I know the first time I got paid for writing was maybe like mid 90s. So I've always enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, around that time, I started writing, you know, I've gotten a lot of stuff published. I've got at least a chat book, if not two or three, done.
Right.
But I'm a teacher, and budgeting wise, I just can't pay reading fees right now.
Well, if you've got two or three chat books, you've got enough for one book.
Right. And so I'm at that point of where, like, well, do I need to end? But still the same thing is like reading fees. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. yeah. Most of the contests do take those damn readings.
Exactly. I just don't have the money for reading fees right now. I just don't have it. And so, what happened was, a friend of mine, Derek Ballard, who's an amazing artist, great artist. He had, he's been working on Adventure Time doing episodes and, title cards, various things like that. And we had worked together, like, it's really weird if I go back through the story, because, like, I was at a coffee shop and I asked him, like, hey, man, I heard you do comics. Like, can I see your work? And, like, I really thought he was going to punch me. Because I think he thought I was, like, kind of screwing with him. Like, oh, yeah, you're kind of like a faggy artist or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, Derek has similar background that I do, you know, very blue collar, growing up pretty rural, pretty fairly poor, that kind of thing.
Right.
And the dude's an amazing artist. And I think the attention that I gave him, and we made a book together, he started sending his stuff out. We got published, like, our first, like, international publication was done together.
And oh, wow.
It was a book called You Ain't No Dancer. And we did a comic together. And we did a few after that. And, like, these things were sold, like, everywhere from, like, New York, Baltimore, Tokyo. They were in stores everywhere. And they were sort of, like, homemade comics and zines and stuff. But, like, he totally made a career out of, like, illustration and stuff. And like I said, like, right now he is able to work on Adventure Time. And he contacted me. The first time he contacted me again was because of a whole situation I can't really talk about.
That's all right.
It
involved drugs, right?
No. It involved, like, a national problem. With a Hollywood star, and
you're a spy, and we don't want to tell anybody.
Yeah, it was a weird kind of thing, because we're still, the thing is like, we still may work with the person, so
gotta keep it on the quiet.
Yeah, initially it was like, hey man, can you check this stuff out? And I checked some stuff out, and we talked, and then he was like, man, you know, and he's, like I said, he's a brilliant artist. So he's like, look, I've got all this work. Do you want to help me write it? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so I can't, like, the thing is I did a lot of work this summer. Like, this summer I was writing like every day.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is I have like almost nothing to show for it, you know? So like, I know, like I can say no doubt about it. Like we have two comic books that are going to come out. One is going to come out in November and it's going to be based on this like bizarre little toy line. And it'll be really cool. Like I got some of the details of it today. It's going to be really neat. Another one is,
can you share the name of that one?
I don't think I can right now.
Okay.
Well, even if, yeah, I just don't want to right now because I just got the name of it today.
Okay.
So I don't want to, I just don't know.
We'll keep it in the pipeline, make sure everybody who's listening knows about it when the time comes.
Yeah, yeah, I know it sounds stupid and weird, but it's just, I just got the name of it today, so
right.
I don't know.
Well, when it gets ready to come out and you're released to say something about it, we'll get you for like a little short interstitial thing.
That would be great, yeah.
Pull you in and talk about it again. But
the second one, we had initially pitched as this cartoon short, because since he's been working on Adventure Time,
right.
We've had a lot of like people interested in cartoons. And so initially we did this, like I did this script and like a breakdown. It was based on characters that he had created. And we had some interest, but then a pretty cool, like independent comic book company was like, they want it. And so there's no deadline exactly on that. So it's going to be depend on when he can draw it, but it's going to be a 24 page Silver Age throwback. So it's going to look like the Silver Age comics.
Oh, cool.
So it's going to be like kind of larger and just like have that kind of mute quality to it. And it's going to have a toy, and the guy doing the toy is a really cool artist. Who's going to do, I assume, the main character, but don't know. I don't know what. That's what I mean. Like, it sounds silly. Like, I worked all summer on this stuff, but I have very little details.
That's kind of the way it goes when you collaborate sometimes.
It's a 60-page comic. The second one's going to be a 24-page comic. Both will probably have toys with them. And because Derek is such a great artist, they are going to look amazing.
Cool.
Those are definite. The other things that we have, this one I just found out recently, like we may be doing an 80s toy line that doesn't exist anymore. We may be doing the rebirth of it. We'll find out later this month.
Oh, wow.
We're in like, it's possible we'll get it. And yeah, I'll talk about it when I
when you can.
Yeah, it's very likely that we may be doing a rebirth of an 80s toy line. That's really cool. I wrote I don't know how many cartoon scripts this summer. And we have a lot of stuff in production meetings.
Right.
And so it's kind of like when you query agents.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we've got a lot of stuff on the table that people say they're behind, but
right.
We just don't know. And we have another thing that's been approved by one company, but we're waiting on the major company, which is Cartoon Network, to approve. Mm-hmm. And we have a story that's our Cartoon Network.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I worked a lot this summer, but I have nothing to show for it right now.
Well, right now.
Yeah. So that's kind of the weird thing. And I've got some friends, you know, around here, like a friend of mine, is a cinematographer here in town, and he worked on a movie that's won a bunch of awards this year. Of course I haven't seen it, so I'm not doing him much good, but like I've been writing with him as well. So yeah, I've been doing a lot. Like, it's totally pulled me away from the essay poetry world that I was in to like writing scripts and things like that.
Right.
But I have nothing to show for it, you know.
Well,
and that'll come eventually. And like we have, the thing is like the cartoon ideas that are like people have been interested in are like really shallow in comparison to the broader idea. I mean, we have some really, really good, deep, broader ideas that we really want to do things with, but you know, we're not going to be able to do that until someone takes a chance.
The first ones, yeah.
Yeah, with something else. So,
well, that sounds cool. And I'm looking forward to seeing some of this stuff roll out.
I am too. I think it'll be good. I hope it'll. Yeah, I mean, I think it will be really good. I'm hoping that it gets at least that far.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things. It's really... you know, oh yeah, this is when we're meeting. This is the time. Like, I just don't know.
Well, it all comes out from just, you know, running out there and, you know, doing what you do on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know, if when you get your name out there on a consistent basis, like you've been doing, you know, spending that week writing haiku for the Washington Post.
Yeah.
You know, just submitting essays and doing stuff with the Drunken Odyssey, you know, even farting around with our little, you know,
which I love,
our little project that has gone into stasis at the moment.
Well, actually, I mean, you've been, you know,
I've got some ideas. We'll talk about it.
Yeah. We need to, billboards is close to hitting 100. The Outrider podcast is, you know, you're consistently doing that. I haven't really heard from anyone else.
Yeah.
So,
and I've got some ideas maybe to drum it back up, drum some life back into it. There's some stuff has been happening around here locally, and I might be able to, you know, just opportunities and locally are disappearing for some people that I roped into writing book reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not getting a chance to show those locally. So we might try and do something.
Yeah, I just started doing, you know, I had to, I was doing book reviews and I really enjoyed it because it really taught me a lot about my reading.
Mm-hmm.
But right now with the school and my writing schedule, I just had to like abandon all of that. I just can't do it, you know.
Yeah,
just can't do it.
Well, you know, book review or write for Cartoon Network. I would write for Cartoon Network.
Well, I mean, that's what it had ultimately come down to, and exactly like I had to make that decision, and it's not that hard.
No, no, the Cartoon Network money. I mean, good grief.
If it happens, yeah. I mean, we've got like we've got some really good stuff lined up. And the thing is, like, eventually, like, if some of this goes, like, we can involve, you know, there are writers that I know that, like, and musicians that I know that, like, I really want to involve in the projects, but, you know, I just have to wait, you know.
Right.
And, like the story, you know, Good as Earthworms, which was for me one of the best experiences I've had. Like, just taught me, like, just listen to an editor. You know, when an editor tells you these things, there are going to be certain things that, like, absolutely you need to do, and there are going to be certain things that
you can throw out.
And it was such a meaningful experience. But like one of the things is like someone told me, like, they read that and they were like, oh, it reminded me of Stephen King and Samuel Beckett. And I was like, that is not anything that I had in mind when I wrote that.
Right. Right.
But those are like absolutely like two of the, like, my favorites. Like, you couldn't have said anything better to me. Like, You know, the only thing that you could have said better was like Ray Harryhausen or like Jan Schwenkmeyer, right. The Brothers Quay, like stop motion animation experts. Like those are the only things that you could have said that like would have made me like, you know, happy that was out there.
Right. Oh man. We could probably go on for another couple hours here, Stephen.
Absolutely.
But I think we need to wrap it up. Thanks for talking to me, and I hope everything works out with the cartoons and the comic books, and we can talk about those again here soon.
Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, when they actually see the light, yeah, maybe.
Don't go anywhere. All right, there you have my conversation with Stephen McClurg. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I enjoyed talking to Stephen. He's a great guy. Great situation. I think he's going to end up ruling the world with all of his projects. So give him a look, give him a visit, and of course be back in 2 weeks for the next Outrider podcast. We'll have another shop talk with Laura Hawley and maybe another guest in there. We're trying to work that out. See you in 2 weeks.